Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Christine Lamberson, and I will be your host today for this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Elliot Gorn, who's a professor at Loyola University Chicago, about his new book called Let the People See, The Story of Emmett Till. And this just came out from Oxford University Press in 2018. Hello, Elliot. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Christine. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Okay. A little chilly in Chicago.
I can imagine. Not so chilly in Texas here, but we appreciate you joining us on the cold day. And to start, I was hoping you might tell us just a little bit about yourself and your career as a historian. This isn't your first book, so maybe tell us just a little bit about how you got interested in history and what kinds of history you've been studying.
Okay. Well, I guess late 60s now, or mid to late 60s. So I've been at it a while. I'm not exactly sure why I became a historian. I think about that all the time. I love history and I love writing history and I love teaching history. But exactly how it happened seems a bit of a mystery. I'm an American historian. I really come out of a graduate program, American Studies. I do American cultural history, and I'm pretty easily bored. So I've written on a number of topics, a book about early prize fighting, a book about the labor organizer, Mother Jones. I got interested in the era of outlaws and gangsters in the Great Depression and wrote a book about John Dillinger and now Emmett Till. So I vary a lot in what I do. And I tell students, since I taught at a few institutions, I tell students I'm in the witness protection program, and they give me lecture notes, and that's how I know what to say.
That sounds great. And how did you get interested in Emmett Till? What brought you to write this book?
That's a good question, and once again, I don't know that I have a good answer, other than that the subject, I started thinking about it around 2009, and I happened to have a Fulbright that year, and I was away, and I kept thinking about it, and the subject wouldn't leave me alone. The more I read, the more I looked into it, the more it seemed like something I needed to do. I kind of wanted to move forward in terms of time and study something a little bit more in my own lifetime, though I have no recollection, direct recollection of the Till murder and trial and so on. But the more I thought about it, the more I read about it, the more I looked into it, the more it seemed like something that was very central to our own times, the post-World War II era. And at the time, also, it was a subject that was not done to death, far from it. There was not that much academic study. So it seemed like, and let me add one other thing that's always important for me. I care a lot about storytelling, and I have to have subjects that are subject to being told as told well as stories. And the Till story is so complicated. It turns in on itself in so many ways. I thought it was an important story to reclaim and to try to tell well.
Okay. So on the one hand, as you say, the Emmett Till story, for especially for a long time, was not the subject of a lot of academic work. There's a couple of books that's come out relatively recently. But it, on the other hand, is in some ways a really well-known story. So I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about that aspect of it. What you think people need to know, and what sort of is missing from those narratives, which of course is a big question, and your book is about a lot of that, but just sort of the aspects of what was missing that make this story important to retell.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story that way. It was an enormous news story back in the summer of 1955. It was covered coast to coast, headline news. The murder, but especially the trial, just a few weeks after the body is discovered, the trial of the two men, and there were more than two involved in the murder, but the two who were tried for killing Emmett Till. Just to go back and tell the story a little bit, most people know it, but they have a bare bones notion of it. Mm-hmm.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah. Emmett Till was a kid who was born and raised, actually, most of his life not in Chicago, but in the little town of Argo at the edge of Cook County. That's important because Argo was no racial paradise, but the town was integrated, the school was integrated, the sports teams were integrated. So he was used to a life that was not either Mississippi or the south side of Chicago. He went down to visit family, his great uncle, Moses Wright, down in a little town of Money, Mississippi. This is a very common thing, families, black and white, from the south, coming to the north over vacation. He goes there to visit, spend time with his cousins and other kin. After he was there a few days, he and a few cousins get in the car and go into town to this little grocery store, Bryant's Grocery Store, that served mostly a black clientele. And the stories vary. The stories changed over time. But one thing that is almost certainly correct, because his cousins who were there said it's correct. When the woman who was taking care of the store, Carolyn Bryant, her husband was away, was out of town, was golfing, was a trucking shrimp down at the Gulf Coast. She came out of the, Emmett Till went in, bought some bubble gum, came out, was watching a Checkers game. She came out and he wolf whistled at her. That story varies, but it seems very clear from his two cousins, Simeon Wright and Wheeler Parker, who were there. They were absolutely certain and always maintained through their life that Emmett Till did whistle at her. Now, Carolyn Bryant later accused him of much, much more than that, of laying hands on him, of making suggestive remarks. It was almost a would-be rape. That she accused him of. All right, a few days go by. Emmett and his cousins go back to Moses Wright's home and so on. They were very afraid. His cousins knew to be afraid of what could result. This is the Deep South in 1955. But some time passes. I think probably the trouble has passed. And then one night, three or four days after the event at the grocery store, Roy Bryant, Carolyn Bryant's husband, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam, come to Moses Wright's home, kidnap Emmett Till, take him away, beat him, and murder him. And the body is found a few days later. That's the story. That's how the story begins.
Okay. And so this, when he's found, this does become a big event at the time. Can you talk a little bit about why it becomes such an important national story?
Well, it's filled with controversy. Who killed him? Why? This is a kid who had just turned 14 years old, who's being accused effectively of a sexual crime. Of when it does go to court, the defense attorneys for the two brothers claimed that this was a sexual assault and that they were defending their homes. And for a lot of people, this is absurd. A kid who has just turned 14, there's not much evidence of this. He's known to be a good kid by everyone who knows him. It's also in the context of this murder takes place just a little more than a year after Brown versus the Board of Education. So it's at a moment when so much is up for grabs in America, in terms of the South, Jim Crow, segregation, and so on. It's one more story about the differences North and South, and also among individuals as to what the country should be doing, where it should be going with this. So the Brown story. I mean, with the Brown decision, the South is in an absolute uproar. This is the era of the citizens' councils, the founding of the citizens' councils, to make sure that the laws of Jim Crow segregation remain, that there is no change in, quote, the Southern way of life. So this murder takes place. It's horrible enough in and of itself, but it's in a very deeply politicized context.
Mm-hmm. And so your book talks a lot about some of the controversies surrounding the murder within this context of a larger controversy surrounding Southern segregation. And so I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about that and about the ways that some of the things we might be very comfortable with or that have sort of become settled in today's context, like calling this a lynching, for example, were major points of discussion at the time.
That is controversial, and in some ways that brings together so many different things, whether this is a lynching or not. Mostly in the Southern press, for example, editorialists, reporters insisting, no, this is a murder. Maybe guys got a little drunk, a little out of hand, that sort of thing. Other papers in the North insisting that it's a lynching, and especially the African-American press, which is very active in this story, very important in the story, insisting this was a lynching, that it was a racial killing, that it went right to the heart of that of the kind of thing that you expected with lynchings, a black male being accused of some sexual impropriety with a white female, that this was about nothing but lynching. Now, that's important because the kind of classic lynching, this horrible public spectacle that we've all seen the photos of, these horrifying pictures, there had been fewer and fewer of those after the 1920s, going into the 30s and 40s. Murders still took place, racial murders, but the public lynching with that quite amazing, the shameless look, people looking right into the camera, white people, with no shame that they had done something good for the community, they felt. That kind of public aspect is gone, but the murders still continue. And that this is this idea that this young lad from Chicago, no less, Chicago, such a symbol of in the South, of Southern, white Southerners see Chicago, African-Americans, out of control. And it is for blacks, the land of hope. So it's very polarized. It's a very, very polarized situation in the summer of 1955.
And how do Southern whites react to this? I mean, one of the things that certainly when I was probably a college student or something like that, I sort of would typically assume that Southern whites just all thought that this murder was basically no big deal. But Southern whites are not nowhere near that kind of cavalier about this. So how are they reacting?
No, certainly not. And it is a range. But again, a range within some limits for the most part. Horrified, this is a horrible thing. But also, the Southern courts will take care of it. Mississippi knows how to deal with this sort of thing, and it will. This is a horrible thing, but let's not make too much of it. Let's just let the judicial system figure out what happened. And then, of course, there are those who just simply minimize it. No, there's absolutely a range. But even so-called Southern liberals, think of Hodding Carter and his Delta Democrat Times newspaper, even Hodding Carter talks about them, or he's horrified by the murder and writes about that. And he's very much in opposition to the hardliners for Jim Crow. At the same time, he simply, again, does toe that line. The courts will take care of it. We'll see what happens. It will work out. So yes, there is a range in the South, but it's a limited range. Opposing segregation in any ardent way is very hard to do there.
And so then what does that trial look like?
The trial is what really gets the attention of not just the national, but even the international press. It takes place only 3 weeks after the body is found. But one important part of the story is that Emmett Till's mother, Mamie Till Bradley, manages to get his body sent back to Chicago. That wasn't a given. Authorities in Tallahatchie County were ready to bury it quickly, get rid of evidence. With a little bit of help from Congressman William Dawson, her congressman, African-American representative, they do manage to get the body out of Mississippi back to Chicago. And she, of course, goes over the body, identifies it. It's in terrible shape. He's been badly, badly beaten, many broken bones, been in the water for 3 days. She identifies the body as her son, and she makes a decision, as she says, let the people see what they did to my boy. At least 100,000, mostly Southsiders, come to the funeral. The body lies in state for a week. The photos are quite amazing of people passing by, looking at Emmett Till, screaming, crying. It's very emotional. It's looking at his face in this open coffin. For so many of them, they were Southerners, African Americans in Chicago, or descendants of Southerners. They were looking into their own history and were angry and took great resolve that he won't have died in vain to change this. So the funeral itself is an enormous event. Now, in the Deep South, journalists often refer to it as Mamie's Circus. Emmett Till's mother, Mamie, it's her circus. So right there's this polarization. And the funeral itself attracts great attention, so that when the trial begins shortly thereafter in the tiny town of Sumner, Mississippi, there's already a built-in audience. It's a little courthouse, still there. Seats maybe 250 people, reasonably well. Something like 400 show up for the daily trial. About 75 of them are journalists. Eventually a dozen or so African-American journalists from the Chicago Defender, the Baltimore Afro-American, the St. Louis Argus. Also very well-known journalists from the mainstream press, Murray Kempton from the New York Post, David Halberstam, who was a young reporter back then for the Tennessean, James Kilgallen, who was a very, very senior reporter, well-known for covering trials. The trial lasts a week or so. A day and a half is spent with jury selection alone, really 3 days of testimony. One of the most dramatic events happens at the very first testimony is Moses Wright. African-American man, has been a farmer in the South, a sharecropper his whole life, very respected. He's a preacher in the Church of God in Christ, very respected in his community. He's asked by one of the prosecuting attorneys to identify the men who kidnapped his nephew. And this is a black man in a white court, and he stands. Do you recognize Roy Bryant? And points and says, there he is. Do you recognize J.W. Milam? Again, points and says, there he is. When he writes about this, Murray Kempton in the Post says, his testimony had to be the hardest half hour in the hardest life imaginable in America. The trial goes like that. There's witnesses, Mamie Till Bradley, a young man named Willie Reed, who was an eyewitness and saw Emmett Till in the presence of Milam and Bryant and others and heard whipping coming, a beating being given, coming from a barn and someone yelling. The trial takes place over 3 days. The judge, Curtis Swango, actually would not allow any race baiting by the defense attorneys. He was a very, very fair judge. Kempton called him the fairest judge he ever saw in his long career. The prosecutors were very, very good. Mamie Till Bradley, after the trial, said so, and some of the other African-American reporters were very impressed with Gerald Chatham. The jury was all white, mostly middle-aged men. Women were not allowed to serve on juries. in Tallahatchie County, which Tallahatchie County was almost two-thirds African-American, not a single person, not a single one could vote. And if you couldn't vote, you couldn't serve on a jury. Of course, that jury, it didn't matter what the testimony was. It was a pretty good case, not airtight, but a pretty good case against the two brothers. Their own confession of kidnapping Till, eyewitnesses seeing him in their presence. The jury voted in an hour that they were not guilty, to not convict. And they talked to reporters and others later, and basically, especially over the years, simply said that they were not going to convict white men of killing a black. It was that simple. It was a classic example of institutional racism, how the jury is determined by the laws of the, that have to do with voting, and that jury would be an all-white jury.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the things I found interesting about your book was your discussion of the prosecutor. And I was wondering if you might talk just a little bit about him and his role here and kind of how he fits into this Southern system.
Yeah, Gerald Chatham was, he was about 50 years old at the time, and not well. He suffered from hypertension. He could have taken himself out and not have been the lead prosecutor in this case, but he decided it was important. He was no flaming radical. He was a segregationist, like almost everyone else there, and yet he also believed in justice and in the law, and that the law had to be enforced. He was very, very clear about that. And again, by all accounts, you read the trial transcript. There is a trial transcript disappeared for 50 years, and the FBI finally found it when they reopened the case in 2004. And it's very clear that he was he very much wanted a conviction for Milam and Bryant. You read the accounts in the newspapers of his closing arguments. This is a man who's not well. He really isn't. And yet he is pounding the table and sweating, and it was apparently just a remarkable performance. He was compared to a Baptist preacher in those closing arguments. He was very, very, he did very, very well.
Mm-hmm. And what's the response to him?
Well, I actually have a chapter where the Delta State University in Cleveland, Mississippi, managed to acquire a lot of the letters that came to him after the trial was over, when he could go home to Hernando, Mississippi, and spend a little time reading his mail. And they are so ugly, the letters from Southerners who consider him a turncoat, from Northerners who think he didn't do enough. I can't repeat the language. I do repeat it, much of it, in the book. But they are just so ugly. There is just simply not much. Well, I shouldn't say that. Some do thank him for his work and his honesty and his devotion. But many of them are just so ugly, abusive letters. There was not a lot of thankfulness there.
Mm-hmm. I found that chapter really interesting, and I was curious what you think. You know, this says about this moment, both in general, but then especially when one's thinking about this Southern system and how initially, at least, a lot of white Southerners who say this was a horrific act, but, you know, the justice system will take care of it. You know, what does this tell us about that narrative?
Well, it certainly tells us that folks did believe, yes, there was a strong belief in justice, and that murdering the innocent was not proper. But that is within the context of a two-tier justice system, of a racially divided justice system. As much of it, of course, is to maintain the image of Mississippi. In Mississippi as a state, I know this is not, how can I say, it's not fashionable to talk in these terms historically. Mississippi is sensitive about its reputation, but it is. Mississippians are deeply, deeply sensitive. They see this as potentially so embarrassing, and they become very, very defensive. And this trial is part of that, that the state looks bad if they don't do justice by convicting these guys who are obviously guilty. But by the same token, that is in no sense does that shake people's belief in the necessity of segregation, of keeping the races segregated, of not just segregated. What goes with that is, of course, it's a caste system, that one race is deemed inferior and treated as inferior, inherently inferior. That's part of the story. The idea of some idea of abstract justice that could be had manages to coexist in people's minds, in white Southerners' minds, with the idea that segregation can continue. That these in no sense contradict each other.
So does that mean this? I think there can be a tendency or a and I see this when teaching about these topics, for example, a tendency or looking back to think of that claim of wanting justice or that this was horrific, to see it in sort of cynical terms, to see that as false. So is part of your reading of these sources to suggest that that's not so much false as that it somehow coexists for these folks while also, or with the general notion that, you know, these men shouldn't be convicted?
Yeah, I do believe that. I don't think most people are cynical about themselves or cynical in their beliefs. I think they do want to believe that they are good-hearted, believe in justice, and so on. I think that sometimes is what makes it very hard for us to understand what motivates people and how they think, how you could look at a system like segregation as it exists day-to-day, as it's practiced day-to-day, and believe that separate could possibly be equal. Of course it's not. It palpably is not. And yet at the same time, there is the faith that the justice system would prevail and would bring justice.
So the men are found not guilty. And your book spends a lot of time on what happens after that, as well as about the memory and development of the story of Emmett Till. And I was wondering if you might talk just a little bit about that phase of his story. And a large portion of your book is about this, so we don't necessarily have to talk about every step of that process. But I was wondering if you might pick one or two moments that you think are particularly important and talk about them.
Sure. And let me say that the story really remains very interesting long after the trial is over, long after Emmett Till is buried and so on. It goes on. The story really does go on for years and years. A few examples. The memory, I actually begin in the introduction talking about a friend of mine remembering seeing Emmett Till's picture, that famous photo of him, his face beaten. Mamie Till Bradley did not allow the mortician to prettify her son. And this friend of mine talked to me about seeing it. And I realized as he described it that no, he did not see that photo. He couldn't have. What he described is a photo that doesn't exist. Well, maybe he saw the photo of the funeral itself, the funeral photo. No. This friend of mine's white, and white people, very, very, very few white people saw that photograph before really before the 80s, before the documentary Eyes on the Prize. It was not republished in any of the mainstream press, the white press. It was reprinted and widely circulated and passed around in Jet magazine and The Defender and other black publications. So that alone is part of the memory and an interesting part of how we remember and misremember the story. But there are other parts of it, I think, that, for example, this is an important, the few months after the end of the trial are very important moments in organizing in the civil rights movement. What's forgotten is that some of the biggest mass rallies over and over again, they take place over weeks, week after week after week, take place after the Till rally. They're called Emmett Till rallies. And the NAACP supports them. Mamie Till Bradley's a speaker. Moses Wright. There's a photographs, for example, of one in the New York Garment Center, supported by labor, unions. In this case, the garment unions. Others, the automobile workers, the packing house workers. Photo in the Garment Center with, it must be 10,000 people. It's probably more than 10,000 people at this rally. These are really important milestones just a few months before the Montgomery bus boycott. Again, part of a long civil rights movement, a long tradition, not just a burst in the 60s, but something that goes on over decades. I think that's important. I think one of the reasons we forget, we were white people, were ready to forget the Emmett Till story, was what became a very famous article in Look magazine by an Alabama journalist named William Bradford Huey, an article that in which the Emmett Till's, the two killers, the two that we knew at the time, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, confess that they killed him. There would be no double jeopardy for them, so they took $4,000 of Look magazine's money to confess publicly to a journalist. Well, that article by Huey does something else. On the one hand, it alienates those two from white Southerners who feel used, and that now they've been outed in the sense for, you know, exonerating these two men who now seem to be guilty. But it also, Huey also paints Till as a sort of a rapacious black man who boasts about having had white girls, white women, having white girlfriends, that he's recalcitrant, that he says to them he's as good as they are. It's a picture of Emmett Till that no one who knew him ever described him that way. It just doesn't make sense that here's a kid being beaten mercilessly, not just by the two, by others too, and that he's in their faces and so recalcitrant. It makes no sense at all. But the Huey article is a kind of fig leaf. It's a kind of way that people can just forget the story, that the two were murderers, that Till himself was out of control. Let's just put this to sleep. And it really does. It really does put the, for the most part, white people stop talking about it. That's an important part of the story. And an important part, I think, is also how it finally, the story does get revived, really in the 80s, partly as African-American history becomes more, becomes taught in schools. We have the show, the TV show Roots. It becomes something of interest to people. And then, like I say, Eyes on the Prize, that six-part series of African-American history, of the history of the civil rights movie, Eyes on the Prize begins with the Till murder. It basically is saying that the civil rights movement begins with the Emmett Till story. And from there, there are many more videos that are made, mostly by African-American filmmakers, and the story starts to take off in memory.
So many U.S. history textbooks, like the Eyes on the Prize documentary, continue to, and sort of popular memory certainly, continue to think of Emmett Till's murder as either a starting point for the civil rights movement, or maybe with a little bit more nuance, think of it as at least a galvanizing point for the civil rights movement that has been sort of bubbling since World War II. So given that those famous images, which are often, you know, a part of that story, are very much part of a segregated story, actually, or a segregated press coverage, more than it's something that everyone is seeing. How do we rethink that story and think about it with more nuance then?
It's really a very interesting question. And for example, if you look at the very earliest histories of the civil rights movement in the 80s, before Eyes on the Prize, they barely mention Emmett Till. One of the problems with the Till story is that, as for the early histories, those histories are about victories. They're triumphalist. The great accomplishments of the 60s, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the stirring stories of, horrifying, but still stirring stories of Memphis and Birmingham and so on, the letter from the Birmingham jail, the rhetoric, the defiance, and so on. The Till story doesn't fit very well with all of that because it is a murder that is where those who commit the murder go unpunished. There are the rallies, of course, to remember, but for the most part, it is largely forgotten at first. And it only starts to come back really in the 80s and beyond. First, the sheer horror of the story of a child, really. Being beaten to death. There's a willingness to think about that and to remember that. There's also a strange kind of a mental sleight of hand, if I can put it that way. If you look at recently the Emmett Till story has been very much back in the news, almost as black background, but it's there all the time. If you look up in the New York Times, Emmett Till and how many times the name has appeared. Except for 1955, the next highest period of time is the most recent years, the last few years. Every time there's another police murder, Emmett Till's name gets mentioned. And along with that goes a sort of assumption. It's appeared in places like CNN, Time Magazine, and so on, that, again, that this is the beginning of the civil rights movement. And that goes with an assumption, a sort of people saw the photo and the scales fell from their eyes. And usually the writers mean white people saw the photos of Emmett Till. Well, it just didn't happen that way. The story was covered, widely covered, but not, it didn't happen that way. The memory takes a long time to come back.
So I have two follow-up questions to that. So first of all, even without the photos, do you think this is a moment where for a lot of white folks, we'll say particularly Northerners, that this story is maybe not a, you know, suddenly they see the light, but a story that does bring some sort of clarity or sharpness to the violence behind the Jim Crow system, especially at a moment when that Jim Crow system has already seen several knocks? Is that sort of image have some accuracy despite the lack of the images, or is it more an image that we like to, you know, superimpose on that moment retrospectively?
Both, I'm afraid. It does matter. The story does matter, and it does add some weight to the uneasiness that many people feel with Jim Crow segregation. But it's a long, long story. I mean, that uneasiness doesn't lead to massive change, say, for example, white people. Desire. I mean, to get any kind of civil rights legislation, there's another civil rights bill was passed in 57, very, very weak legislation. And just getting that was very, very difficult. Anti-lynching legislation, which we go back to Ida B. Wells in the 19th century, the early 20th century. And we finally, the Senate, the United States Senate, just passed anti-lynching legislation. So it's, you know, we kind of want that moment when things change, and it often doesn't happen that way. There's just a kind of weight of history, a kind of weight of events that keep piling up and piling up, and finally some kind of opportunity comes, and people are willing to finally, as the 60s happen, those who for one reason or another were queasy about segregation, were queasy about the racism, the white supremacy of America, finally have had enough. That's the way I think I would think about it.
Mm-hmm. And so then my second question is why this story has become so important more recently. Do you have a sense of that?
Yes. The Emmett Till story is in many ways very different from the Anne Frank story, but still in each case, a single horrific murder comes to stand for the larger whole. In the Emmett Till case, again, they're very, very different, right? But a young person, a person clearly innocent, that innocent blood will be spilled. I think also one of the things with Anne Frank and Emmett Till is that, again, the old expression, and I'm afraid I'm quoting Joseph Stalin here, that the death of one is a tragedy and the death of a million is a statistic. This is how we understand it. But there's something much more, too, I think, why the Emmett Till story has come back as we become aware, more aware of something that's been under our noses for a long time, and that's the injustice of the judicial system with respect to African Americans. No, what happened in Sumner is not the same as what happened to Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or any of the others who were murdered, whose names we've heard and know. But all of them were failures, deep failures of the justice system, where justice should have been done and wasn't done. And Till has really become a shorthand for that, of a grave, grave injustice. So that if you go back and you look at the reporting of many of those more recent murders, almost automatically, many journalists began with the Emmett Till story, began their reports. It's amazing how common that became, almost a trope of trying to understand our more recent troubles.
That's really interesting and something that I haven't spent a lot of time keeping track of quite as closely. So, yeah.
It's not something anyone would notice unless Emmett Till is very much on your mind, like you're writing a book and then suddenly it just leaps out over and over again. In the epilogue of the book, I talk about how people as diverse as LeBron James, Oprah Winfrey, Dave Chappelle have brought up the Till case in the last couple of years in very, very different contexts. LeBron James, for example, when, I don't know if you remember recently, within the last couple of years, someone scrawled the N-word on the gate, the fence outside of his home in Los Angeles. And the next day he calls a press conference and LeBron James says, you know, when I saw that, I immediately thought of Mamie Till Bradley. I can't be silent. I can't just act like it isn't there, paint it over. I have to talk about it. And this has happened over and over again with the Till story. It just has been very much out there again.
So I want to shift gears just a little bit, though, maybe continuing along the more present day aspect and talk a little bit about your research. And I was wondering if you could tell us both a little bit of what type of sources you use, but also the experience of doing research. And in particular, you mentioned, I think it's probably in the introduction, but kind of just those casual conversations that you sometimes have with people when you're writing a book and the extent to which there is still quite a bit of polarization surrounding this case.
I certainly, a few times in Mississippi, certainly got the impression that people were sort of, well, why are you looking into this? And don't we know about that? And do we need more about it? And sometimes a little worse than that, that was certainly there. I spend some time, as I say, in Mississippi doing research, a lot of places. The Carter Woodson Library in Chicago, down on the South Side, has the famous Vivian Harsh collection of African-American materials. So a little bit of time in New York in the Schomburg collection. But especially federal collections, the National Archives, the Justice Department, State Department, actually, the United States Information Agency was very involved in covering Till for American networks overseas. It was, as I say, it was an international story. The story certainly took me a lot of places, presidential libraries, the Eisenhower Library. Of course, a lot of newspaper materials. It's hard to do it without newspapers. When the FBI reopened the case in 2004 through 2006. They also, as I say, they produced the trial transcript, which allowed me to write a pretty long section of the book. I mean, when someone hands you something as dramatic as a trial, you use it. And it really allowed me to hear voices and hear voices, allow the reader to hear voices talking to each other in some ways of the segregated South and the African Americans who were opposing that and so on. So that was important. I also managed to get 1,000 pages or so of from a Freedom of Information Act request from the FBI from when they reopened the case. And that was very interesting material also to have. The case file actually was something like 10,000 pages, but that was very useful. So what was the experience of doing it? You know, let me just say one thing that's only occurred to me now that the book is finished. As I was writing this book, it seemed harder to write than other books I'd written. And it seemed, I thought, well, you know, maybe I've just been doing this too long and I'm getting old. It's just getting harder. And that might be true. But I think I realized only when it was finished, when it was copy edited, put to bed, that even just writing about this story is a kind of emotional burden. You know, God forbid the burden that people carried who lived it. But even just immersing myself in it and writing about it was there was a kind of grind in it that I didn't even quite realize was there, and only realized it after it was finished.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great book, and I'm really glad that you did write it. I enjoyed reading it, and I hope that our listeners will check it out as well.
I agree with you.
Very good. So we traditionally, as our last questions, ask if you're working on anything at the moment.
I will be working on a book. I hope. I think much of it is smaller things that I've published before. A book called "Violent Men," about American history and violence. But it'll be more article length things that sort of tie together with each other.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you so much for joining us today and for talking about the book with me.
Thank you very much.